Hello and welcome to Moaz. Over 600,000 Rohingya refugees have arrived in Bangladesh since August 25th, 2017. And that's according to data collected by the UN and other aid agencies operating there. As the crisis was unfolding, we spoke to Pablo Gallego of Exchange.org. He just got back from Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh, and was starting a survey about the newly arriving Rohingya refugees. Since his return, Pablo and his team have been working solidly, collecting and analysing data from the field team. Now they're set to publish their findings. On the 15th of December, we'll get to explore the events which took place, shedding light on the incidents, abuses and journeys they've taken. Listeners will find some of the descriptions in this podcast upsetting. We caught up with Pablo Gallego and Maria Jones of the Exchange team to find out more. This is the second time Exchange has investigated the Rohingya crisis.
We did a survey in 2016, which was focused on the migration trends on Rohingya people. And after the attacks of October, November 2016, we started thinking about documenting all these crimes happening in northern Rakhine. We've been working from the beginning of the year to come out with a project, a documentation project. And when this incident happened in August 25th, we saw that was our opportunity to go to Bangladesh and start collecting data and testimonies from the Rohingya refugees.
Where did you conduct your surveys and who helped you?
So we conducted the surveys in Cox's Bazar, in particular in seven different camps, from Nayapar in the south to Kutampalong in the north of Cox's Bazar. And we had a team of four enumerators. All of them were Rohingya refugees from different crises. Three of them were Rohingya refugees from 1992 crisis, so they arrived after that crisis. And one of them was actually a refugee from 2012.
What kinds of incidents did you uncover in the research?
Well, I mean, they were extremely varied, the incidents, but there were some which came up really quite frequently. For example, the burning of buildings. This was used all the time. People's houses were burned, entire villages were razed to the ground. This was something that I came across all the time in the data. In addition to this, something which I found quite surprising was the amount of rapes and gang rapes that were being conducted, actually, quite systematically, as well as the killing of children and the means by which, you know, the perpetrators were killing children, for example, by throwing them in fires or into rivers.
The military were setting fire to my village and they forcibly entered my home. They raped me and stabbed my husband. My young child was taken from me and thrown into one of the fires. I cried out when it happened and they raped me again.
Who was perpetrating these abuses and why?
For the most part, it was the Burmese military. But in addition to this, it was different actors, extremists, Buddhist extremists, Rakhine extremists, various other ethnic groups which had been pitted against the Rohingya population.
Also Rakhine, local Rakhine, and the Hindu, Kuin, Sakma, Mema, and the, also police, and the military.
Muzung
means all of them.
With the incidents you were told about, how did you verify that they had happened?
So the verification is being done afterwards, so we have checked on the internet news portals were releasing and incidents in the same village and at the same time. And also we've been using satellite imagery from other NGOs. Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, they have released satellite imagery showing the villages that were burned during the attacks. So we could actually see that the information, the testimonies we were gathering were happening actually in the same locations reported by those NGOs.
What challenges and difficulties did you face conducting the surveys?
Yeah, the location of villages was actually a major issue for us. The main problem is that there are two names for the villages. There is a Burmese name, and there is also a Rohingya name. Many of the Rohingya refugees, they don't actually know the Burmese name. So it was actually very hard to find some of the villages, because on the maps, like normally you get the Burmese name, not the Rohingya name. So we have to investigate and try to find what was the Burmese name for a given Rohingya name. That took us around 1 week of work to geolocate all the villages. Well, we haven't geolocated all the villages. We managed to geolocate 1,060 villages out of the whole data set, which is 1,300.
I've been suffering for the past 2 months because of the military extortion. When the military eventually entered the village, they did not allow any men to stay, so we would have to quickly leave whenever they came. When they found a man, they would say, "Why are you staying? This is not your country. This is not your village. You are all Bengali, so go to Bangladesh." When we said that they cannot go and this is their land, the military started shooting and setting fire to our houses and our buildings in the village. We then ran to the paddy fields with our families to take shelter. We stayed there for 3 or 4 days without food or water. We could not go back because they had burned our village down.
What trends did you discover about the journeys taken by the Rohingya, and how many entry points did you find?
So most of the Rohingya refugees, they crossed the Naf River. It took them an average of 7 days. There's not like a long distance from those villages to Cox's Bazar. But some of the Rohingyas, especially living in South Mondo and Ratadong, they did the sea journey. So instead of crossing the Naf River, they went, they sailed the Bay of Bengal towards the western coast of Cox's Bazar, in particular to the village of Shanlapur. And there are like many entry points. We managed to find only 20 of them, because basically they were the most common entry points, and they were all along the borderline from the south of the peninsula to actually to the north, and the differing entry points. I say that we managed to geolocate 20 entry points.
It was the afternoon when we tried to cross the river to escape. The boat's engine failed and we started taking on water. I was with my wife, my son's wife, and my granddaughter. They all drowned. We recovered their bodies and took them somewhere we could bury them.
This person shouldn't be a good person, because they don't fear border guard anyone. If you are a border guard, I am a fisherman, I'm using boat. If you arrest me, I can pay you, because I don't have any license to pass refugee. So that's what I use smuggler, because there I know there's a trafficker. They are a smuggler and trafficker. Someone don't have money to pay them, they snatch gold.
When the smuggler asks to the passenger to pay the money, then when they refuse to pay the money, they tell the smuggler the book. the boatmen were less able to boat on the
If they see, if a woman seems like beautiful, nice, so they don't allow her to go anywhere. They just keep.
And there we are also keep now.
If you are seem like a gentleman, they will charge you 10 lakh at least. So if you are seem like poor, they will charge you per person 1 lakh. If you say, I don't have money or anything, do you have gold or anything expensive? No, I don't. When I ask them, did you pay money to cross the border? When I ask them, they say, yeah. Who are they, border guard or smuggler? They say, they don't know. As I ask them, if you don't have money, how you can take home to Hesbut? They say like before we get on to the boat we have to manage the money. If you don't have, we have to manage the boat. If you can't pay, they do many things secretly with the guard, as they say. Because when the smuggler enter into the border of Bangladesh, when everyone have left the boat and the smuggler pay the money to the BDR. Who is a border guard? As I asked them, have you ever seen that the trafficker paying the money to the border guard? They say many people don't know, but some they say we saw, but secretly they don't show people that they are paying.
We just listened to audio of some of the enumerators discussing the stereotypical characteristics associated with the smugglers. Is this across the board or just in some cases?
From a point of view, I think they were non-organized fishermen that took the advantage of the situation, and actually we could see that they, you know, they didn't have a fixed price for the refugees to pay, but depending on the profile of the refugee, they would request more or less money. Also, you could see that in some entry points they were like the prices they had to pay, they were higher because the river was also wider, so the distances from Rakhine State to Bangladesh were larger, but there was no like a fixed price for an entry point. There were like huge differences.
There's a suggestion of a link between the Bangladeshi border guards and the smugglers. Did you discover more about this?
I cannot tell you, you know, that, you know, there was such a thing. We were not asking exactly if they were, you know, coordinated with the Bangladeshi authorities. My impression is that they didn't, because they could enter like freely. And actually those entering through the north of the Cox's Bazar, they could walk freely from Myanmar to Bangladesh, and they didn't pay any money. They just walked through. So there were actually the Bangladesh authorities after this after the August 25th, they opened borders. That was my impression. There was no difficulties for them to enter. Apart from the river.
Did people want to return if things changed?
Well, in that case, we wanted to know to what extent they would, you know, return to Myanmar. I haven't asked the questions directly, but yeah, the enumerators, they said that obviously they want to go back. They you know, they feel like they left their homeland. And they left all their life behind to come in a country that, you know, doesn't belong to them. But at the same time, they fear, you know, persecution, and they basically wouldn't return if the conditions doesn't change.
It was night time when the military forcefully entered my village of Bangnama and started shooting indiscriminately at the villagers. Everyone was afraid and some managed to flee, but 4 people were killed. We took shelter in neighbouring villages and the following night we returned to bury the bodies. The very next morning, the military started burning the villages.
From a personal perspective, how did it feel to be going through this data?
It's not the easiest thing to do, to read through testimony after testimony of, you know, glaring human rights abuses, often truly horrific stories, including mutilation, killing of children. But ultimately, like, this is something that is going to feed into a very important report. And the reason that we're doing this report is to ensure that these stories aren't forgotten. At the end of the day, I'm sat in my office going through data very comfortably. These people are in a foreign country now with nothing and have gone through horrific abuses. So that's really what I have to keep on reminding myself, that the report is the most important thing and hopefully it will have some kind of impact.
The Rohingya Survey 2017 is due for release on the 15th of December. And you'll be able to find out more by following the links on the MOAS website. If you like this podcast, don't forget to hit like, comment, and subscribe for more podcasts from us. You can follow us on our social media. Check out our latest updates on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and Audioboom. Or you can donate to help us provide urgent medical assistance to Rohingya refugees. From all of us here at MOAS, goodbye.